Welcome to the No Sitting on the Sideline Dad podcast, a podcast about a journey of discovery and conversations about not sitting on the sideline of life. Let's get involved. Here's host Joe Foley.
Hey, welcome back to the No Sitting on the Sideline Dad podcast. I'm your host, Joe. And as always, I'm thrilled to have you join me for another episode where we dive deep into the art of proactive parenting and personal growth. Hey, we're stepping slightly outside our topic, but usually well within the realms of practicality and resilience, which we know as the key pillar of our discussions here. We're exploring something incredibly relevant, not just historically, but our lives today, wartime, home front, essential skills. Now you're wondering, Joe, what does it have wartime to do with us right now? Well, turns out quite a lot, actually. There are skills in our ancestors refined during challenging times to manage home and support the community effectively. Skills like gardening, preserving food, making the most of limited resources. We're only fascinating about incredibly useful for us today, but as we aim to lead more sustainable, self-sufficient lives. And to help us navigate the skills, understand the modern-day application, today I'm thrilled to introduce Marjorie Wallcraft, founder of the Grove Network. She's been on the podcast before, but I'm glad to have her back as a valuable resource for those pursuing resilient lifestyle. As a committed affiliate, I'm eager to explore the abundance of knowledge, especially how it aligns with the No Sitting on the Sideline Dad. So we're a seasoned gardener, DIY enthusiasts are just starting to think about how you can be more self-reliant. Today's episodes, we're going to share some interesting, actionable advice. So let's get ready to learn from the past to empower the future. And which said, let's bring on the guest, my guest, who is expert in bringing those historic skills into modern practice. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We're living in really crazy times. I think everybody's life is in some kind of vortex of change right now. Actually, just for folks listening, but Joe and I were going back and forth and the date slipping and the time slipping, but both of us are running around like crazy. We got this going now.
I've got it going now.
Yeah. So some people are like, well, what are you talking about wartime? But, how does that affect us here? And I don't necessarily want to go in on this podcast of who we're at war with, but I want to assure you that we are at war. And it is keeps happening here in the United States, Canada, Mexico. It's happening all over the world. And one of the first things you do at wartime is to destroy the food supply. And there has been a very systemic approach. There has been a very systemic plan and attack on the food supply. And this is global. Yeah, you can see it in the grocery store. I don't think anybody can deny it. Like, prices are going up, and they're going up, and they're not slowing down or plateauing.
But one thing I wanted to touch base on in the beginning, so people know more about you. I know about you because we talked before and stuff. But a little bit more about the Grow Network and what is their mission and mission statement? What are their mission to help people?
Yeah, so the purpose of the Grow Network is to stop the destruction of the earth because commercial agriculture is the most destructive force on the planet. And seriously, they all kinds of poisons and everything. It's horrible what they do. And then let's not talk about meat production. It's how barbaric that is. And our mission is homegrown food on every table. And honestly, that mission statement is a little bit of a joke, a tongue-in-cheek joke, because honestly, throughout all of history, except for possibly the last century, that's all there was homegrown food on every table. And our food supply right now is so unsustainable. That is what will happen in the future, is there will only be homegrown food on your table. And so, like I said, it's kind of a joke. And it's just a matter of, do you want to embrace it, prepare for it, start adapting, doing it now? Or do you want to be drugs from the mud and accept it later?
But one thing was interesting too, while preparing for the interview and stuff like that, I found something out that I didn't realize, but during the world wars, they had a thing called victory gardens. You ever heard of that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The victory gardens go back. They actually started in, most people associate them with World War II, but it actually started in 1913, 1914. There were food riots going on here in the United States because the food prices were going up because, the whole world was getting ready to go into World War I. Contrary to popular belief, by the time we got to World War II, it had more government traction, but it was initially only a citizen-led effort to start getting more and more people growing food in their backyards. And, it started during World War I, and it continued on through the Great Depression, and then it got a lot more traction again during World War II and actually had U.S. government support at that time to help people make it through that time. Here, oh, Joe, you want to hear like an amazing factoid about that time period? Yeah. So, you know, the 1940s, people had kind of gotten a little modern and were, you know, weren't as living off the land as they used to. In 1 year, 20 million novice gardeners started Victory Gardening and produced 40% of the produce that this country ate. In 1 year, like 20 million people who had never grown food before said, hey, I'm going to start gardening, growing food, produced a huge amount for this country during that wartime. And I say, hey, we can do it again. We can absolutely do it again.
Well, it was interesting too, like, especially in the supermarket. I love eggs for breakfast. I have at least 2 eggs for breakfast every morning. There is farms around, but I usually buy from the grocery store. And I can tell when the price is going up because, wow, it was $1.99, $1.50, a dozen, brown, large brown. All of a sudden, we're at the store going, it's $4. What's going on here? And all of a sudden, like bread, like the war in Ukraine, supposedly it's a bread basket of the world. And we get a lot of grain from and stuff like that from Ukraine. I'm like, wow, that could be real devastating too.
Yeah, they're estimating that the Ukraine, well, think about it, like every able-bodied man has been sent out to the front, basically, in Ukraine. Like, they're now recruiting, apparently, you know, old people that they've let out of the insane asylum. And they're really, really struggling for manpower over there. Nobody's farming. Like, you know, that we estimate that maybe they'll produce 5% of what they normally produce, but I mean, the fields are bombed out. They've hardly any able-bodied men, equipment, infrastructure destroyed. That's a huge amount of food production going offline right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know it may have gotten to your attention, but there's a whole bunch of protests, farmer protests that are going on in Europe.
Oh, yes. I heard about that, actually.
Yeah. And on the surface of it, we're all laughing and having a good time. It's kind of fun because, you know, you see these footage of these farmers spraying this, you know, manure all over a government building or something like that. And you're like, oh, no, you know, we're afraid. It's actually way more serious than that. So they started in the Netherlands, and the government there just started making a bunch of, it's all these governments around the world have become psychotic. So they made these really, really bizarre laws that made it virtually impossible to farm. So, for example, they increased tariffs on all kinds of fertilizers and imports. And then they said, oh, well, now when you buy, let's say you got to buy a tire to fix your tractor, well, you're going to have to pay for the disposal of that tire, even though you're probably going to use it for, you know, 7 to 10 years. So it makes the price of the tire completely out of reach, right? And so all these farmers in the Netherlands, it started in the Netherlands, like they're multi-generational family farms. Their backs are up to get, they can't farm anymore. They have nothing left to lose. And so when you see those farmers driving their tractors right through police barricades and running, chasing police down, and they're doing that for a very good reason. Like, they have been put out of business. Well, that same thing started to happen across almost all the EU countries. So France, Spain, Italy, Belgium, Germany, they were different laws, but the legislatures in all those different countries came up with crazy rules that made it virtually impossible for those farmers to farm. So the Netherlands, actually, people don't realize it, but in Europe, if it's forbidden, it's a little tiny country. They produce a huge amount of meat and dairy products. And that's probably, most of that is going to go offline. And I don't know how many of those farmers in Europe are going to farm this year, this spring. How many of them are planting with the crazy legal situation? Now, a lot of us were watching that and going, well, that's Europe. And then about a month ago, hundreds of small farms in Oregon got cease and desist letters. And the state of Oregon says, hey, if you have a barn where you have concrete on it or gravel, we're going to define it as a CAFO, which is a confined animal housing operation. And they basically come up with all this legislation to supposedly protect the groundwater. And well, if you have $100,000 worth of equipment, then you can bypass it, which no farmer has. And they basically started shutting down hundreds of small farms in Oregon. Now, there was a huge backlash, myself and a bunch of other people, because, like, this ain't right, you know, because those are not CAFOs, those are people with 2 cows, right? Or 10 cows, or, you know, an acre farm garden. It's not big, right? You know, this is local, organic, fresh food that we want. You know, the local food chain. And so they backed also that, but all of us know, okay, so we're going to circle back around. And we said, well, maybe that's just Oregon, because, you know, Oregonians, like, they're a little bit different, you know. But sure enough, just a couple of weeks ago, Maine sent 50 farms they have condemned. And this was basically entrapment. So all of the municipalities across the United States compost the solid waste. So the stuff in the sewage, right? They compost it, which, you know, I suppose that's a better way of dealing with it than they used to dump it out in the ocean or burn it off. But the thing is that compost contains a lot of what's, you know, you think about your hospitals that throw stuff in the sewage, yeah, or light industry, or your, you know, your Aunt Lily who no longer wants that furniture polish. There's all kinds of stuff in the heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, and just all kinds of chemicals are in that cannot get composted out. And the municipalities sell the compost to farmers, and the cities encourage the farmers to take this compost and use it. And the FDA and the USDA said, oh, yeah, it's safe, and they've certified it safe, even though many, many, many independent tests have said, no, this is loaded with horrible chemicals. This is loaded with heavy metals. This is not good for human consumption for plants. But the USDA says, no, it's safe. And so actually Maine encouraged a bunch of these farmers to use this compost. And now they're going back to those farms and saying, oh, you know, you've got forever chemicals in your soils and we're going to condemn your farms. So, I mean, serious entrapment. So we're all like, what? Like, so is this a repeat of what's going on in the EU? I mean, we're watching this closely. Like, is this going to start happening in a lot of different states in the US? But basically, we are at war, and it's really bizarre. It's like some kind of weird guerrilla war. That million acres in Texas that just got torched, there's a lot of evidence that those were not natural fires. Texas is the largest beef producing state in the nation, and 85% of the beef that Texas produces is in that area up in the panhandle that was just torched. So we got a huge chunk of the beef herd has been destroyed. And before that fire, the beef herd in the United States was at levels we haven't seen since the 1960s. So already the herd was pretty small. The population in the U.S. has more than doubled since the 1960s. So we were already going in without a lot of resources, and then we just had a whole bunch more destroyed. So we are at war, and it's not necessarily being talked about. There's been a spate of different food processing plants that have had mysterious fires happen to it. There's all kinds of just really weird small things going on that when you look at it cumulatively, you're like, we're taking a big hit to the food supply here.
Well, it's interesting too. I was thinking about all the land being bought up by certain like billionaires for like to make soy. That one of them was soy. One was buying up because cows fart too much. And the other one's like, all of a sudden, there's a big strain of bird flu.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that is like the next tactic they're using is this bird flu. And by the way, let's address that right now. The way to handle bird flu is to let it run through your flock and kill off whoever it kills off, and then you keep the rest of the flock to build from, right? You don't you don't get good genetics by killing off the entire flock. When you're developing breeds, that's what you do. You let if there is something that comes through, and you know it's unfortunate. Nobody likes to see that kind of unnecessary death. But you don't kill off the whole flock just to get rid of the bird flu. What you do is you let the bird flu run through it. And then you keep the survivors and breed from that. And then you breed in immunity. That's how you handle bird flu. They just killed 1.6 million chickens a couple of weeks ago. In the last 2 years, they've killed due to bird flu, under the bird flu excuse, 87 million chickens in the U.S., which is 22% of our egg-laying flock.
It's a crazy time right now. I'm thinking about all the situations. I know the Grow Network talks about different stuff like helping people, you know, grow food, buy land, DIY stuff and stuff like that. But now I was talking to my son's grandfather, Mike, and he come from a poor family. He's almost close to me in 80. And he mentioned they would go to the local pond and they would catch whatever they catch. That's what they ate for the dinner that night. And it was interesting stuff like that. And he has a garden out back and Some of the stuff is amazing. Honestly, this time of year, I love, especially when the strawberries come out. Me and my son like going pick strawberries. Mm-hmm. And we have a little, it's a fun time because I point, he goes and picks them. And then we have a fun thing called, this is how with the nickname, it's kind of funny, called Juicies. Find the Juicies. Let's go find the Juicies. It's kind of a game, but I point them out and digs them out. We have like a pint like this, but those seem to taste better, especially like cucumbers. For some reason, it's a totally different taste.
Totally different. It absolutely is totally different. You know, and that's really the good news on all of this is that growing your own food is actually, you know, first of all, it's in your genetics, right? Other than this last century or so, everybody grew some food, you know, backyard gardens, chickens, rabbits, goats, whatever. I mean, everybody had a little bit of food production going on. All of the heirloom varieties of vegetables we have came from your great-great-grandparents, you know, and a lot of them couldn't read. They certainly didn't have Google, you know. And it is fun. I was just on a show yesterday with Sarah Westall, and we are chatting. And she goes, I just don't know about if I could do this. And she said, but my kids, I'm looking at, she has 40 plants lined up on a windowsill, and her kids are totally, I'm like, yeah, because it's in your genetics. It's totally, we know how to, you know, this is not only just something that we really do love to do, we know how to do, but it really is enjoyable, and it's hugely productive. Like I show people a really simple system for how to grow at least half of your own food in a backyard size space. And it really only takes about a half an hour a day. And I've taught this now actually to millions of people. And I personally know of tens of thousands of people that have implemented it. And I've taught it to young kids. We did it at a school, and I've taught it to elders. It's, you know, anybody can do it. It's actually really designed for people who know nothing and maybe they're older or out of shape.
But I was listening to one of the interviews the last time, and you talked about the butchery thing, butchering on meat and stuff like that. And I'm kind of curious what you meant by roadkill.
Just for everybody listening, what Joe's talking about is I put together this series called the Wartime Homefront Essential Skills Series, which is airing for free this weekend on the 27th and 28th of April. And so we got, you know, how to grow food, backyard food production, food preservation, beginner's foraging, property purchase checklist. And then we do have one on roadkill, which is a really, really fun presentation. My friend Red Bluefish, immigrant to the United States, only job he could get was being a courier. And he found driving all the roads that he was finding all this roadkill. And he just started to figure out, hey, it's organic, free range, just was killed recently. It's good meat. And there's a lot of distinction. Like, it's a very useful skill to know. You know, pulling fur or looking at the eyes or looking at rigor mortis or not, you know, how long has this thing been dead and is the meat good to eat or not? And it's surprising how often that meat really is good to eat, but there are some signs to learn. And then home butchering, honestly, it was not that long ago that when mama said to the kid, the kids traditionally took care of the chickens, did egg collection and managed the hens and all that. And normally when mama said, you know, go get me a chicken, what she meant was, we're going to have chicken for dinner tonight, go get a hen and butcher it and bring it to me ready to cook. So, I mean, butchering small game used to be, I almost hate to say, it's like tying your shoes, like everybody knew how to do it, but I don't know if anybody knows how to tie their shoes anymore either. So these skills are super, actually really easy to learn, and they're easy to do. I believe that we've been programmed not to do this. You know, if you think about every movie you ever watch, if there's a farmer in there as a character, he is portrayed as an idiot or kind of stupid, mm-hmm. you know, or if there's anybody who's doing any gardening, it might be somebody who's really older and has lost their mind or something. And they really portray this in a very negative light, or the only people who have anything to do with growing food or picking it is the desperate people, migrants. But it's not at all true. It's just like you talked about with your son, it is the most enjoyable activity. And I promise you, when your son gets older, he's going to always remember those strawberries. I did a whole series of interviews with baby boomers, elders, and I said, what's your favorite memory of your grandparents? And it always, it was never like, oh, they took me to the skating rink, or we went to see a movie. It was always, oh, no, we dug potatoes, or we collected eggs, or it had something to do with food production. My own personal memory of my great aunt Julia, she had an apple tree in her front yard and we made applesauce. You know, it's always around food and food production that kids remember the most. So it's a wonderful activity.
Well, I was just thinking about all the stuff, the modern society now, everything's so quick. We don't think about it. We just go to the store and buy it and stuff like that. And recently I was colorizing old pictures from my great aunt back from the 1920s and 1910s. And everybody has like one or two suits. They pretty much wore them the whole time. And back then they grew the food and stuff. And I was thinking about all the modern amenities we have now. And I'm not saying we've gotten away from it. I don't want to say lazy, but we got more complacent. That's a good word.
We had these centralized systems that basically did it for us. It was convenience, honestly. Mm-hmm. That food is not really that nutritious. I mean, it's really gone way past the point of its usefulness. You know, the food that they produce is not nutritious at all. In fact, it's actually toxic for you. We used to say, well, you go to the grocery store to be a perimeter shopper, right? That's not even, there's really nothing even in the perimeter anymore. So if you want to be healthy, you really need to grow your own food. And I say that the act of the growing food is actually more health beneficial than the delicious produce. When you grow it in your backyard and you hopefully you're working and you're doing your best to have really good soil, you can taste it. Like you can taste the minerals. Your tongue and your mouth knows high quality food, and you can taste it. And it's really, really delicious. And there's almost nowhere that you can buy that stuff anymore. So it's pretty much something you need to go do in your backyard.
Well, you mentioned too, like also, I drove by somebody's house recently on the way to work, and they had a modern neighborhood. It wasn't like a farmland back, but they had raised plant beds, and there was tons of them. I'm like, that is awesome. That is great to see. But another thing you mentioned, like, well, the modern, like going to the grocery store and all the chemicals and all that stuff. And I had a loaf of bread from the local grocery store, and I'm like, that thing was still pretty decent. Two and a half weeks after I bought it, I'm like, that's some serious chemicals. And I got rid of it, but it was, I mean, I didn't even open it because I'm like, it's a waste of money because I didn't even eat the bread. But I noticed, I'm like, it's still pretty good. It has a little smell to it, but it looks like it's still pretty decent. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of chemicals in that.
A friend of mine had a bag of organic apples, right? And she didn't know this at the time. They spray the apples with, and it's still considered organic. They spray it with something, is it called a peel or something? There's some chemical they spray it with. And that apple will look good and look, you know, fresh for years. Like you may be buying it. It could be an organic bag of apples and it could be more than a year, 2 years old with this chemical they put on it. And a friend of mine has moved. I live in Puerto Rico and she moved here and you put your stuff in a container. And then the container sits on docks and on ships and it takes months to get to you, right? And so she's unloading this container and she'd accidentally left a bag of these organic apples in this container. And she thought, oh, that's going to be awful. She pulls it open and they look perfect. She says, he's not even going to compost that. That's like, those apples should have been well past rotten, you know? And she said they look perfect. I'm like, oh my God, what they're doing to food. It's egregious.
There's one thing that was interesting. You mentioned organic. I'm not saying it's a myth, but is it some things organic, some things don't need organic? I'm not sure. I don't know if you can explain that to me because I'm kind of curious and I always get it mixed up.
Well, they do. They talk about the dirty dozen. Like, you know, there's some vegetables and fruits that you really should get organic because they have less toxins on them. You know, so I think like bell pepper, strawberries for one, right? You definitely want to make sure you know where they were grown. Like they're the most heavily pesticided or chemicalized fruits out there. And you can look it up, the dirty dozen. But honestly, it really, organics may have less of toxins in them. But once the USDA got into the organic brand, once they usurped the organic brand about a decade or so ago, it's been so deteriorated. You know, organic is going to help you a little bit, but really, we're at the point where you really have to grow your own food. You just, like I just said with the organic apples, they can spray this chemical on there that makes that apple almost turn into a Twinkie. And it does not have to be put on the label anywhere. It's okay with the organic standards. The organic standards have been bought out by big industry. It's such a shame that this is the world we live in. On the other hand, you know, growing your own food is just really pleasurable and enjoyable. For me, I get up in the morning, my routine, I get up in the morning and I do my prayers and meditation, you know, the inner work and spirituality. And then I'd go out into the yard, my bare feet on the grass, the sun's coming up, there's birds singing, I'm working with my plants, I'm working with my livestock, and that is the best, you know, half an hour, hour out of my day. I just love it. And then my mind's clear, come back in the house and do the coffee and say, okay, what am I going to accomplish today? But, you know, which is like interviews and business and, you know, all the stuff that we have to do. But every morning, and I just love it. And it's the best part of my day. And then in the evening, I usually do a couple of minutes round just to check on everybody. And you know, Joe, I did a whole series of interviews with like really, really high powered people. Like this one guy was an executive with a healthcare company. He had a division, his employee, 2000 employees under his division, quite a few high tech startup firms. Like their seed capital was 25 million and they were doing all these crazy innovative things with marketing firms. And I was interviewing these CEOs or founders, and the one thing they had in common is all of them grew some of their own food.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, they all did. And you know, of course, they could buy anything they wanted. I mean, this is money was absolutely not a part of the equation, right? And every one of them said they did it for stress relief. Like it's they're highly productive type A people, and being outside growing some of your own food, you're still being productive, but yet you're doing it in a very harmonious, natural, de-stressing way. It was, you know, it was their favorite part of their day too, before they had to, you know, hit the hit the books and hit the computer and hit the meetings and do all the stuff. So, and they were so proud, you know, like, look at this. I mean, he'd show me pictures of like, oh my God, look, I got this dozen eggs and look at all the different colors. Or this one guy made his own sauce, tomato sauce and or salsa or whatever. I mean, they actually really producing something tangible was such a wonderful thing for them and unique. A lot of the heirloom variety, you can, there's a lot of stuff that you can grow yourself, but you cannot buy anywhere. You just can't buy it. That you have to grow it yourself. So those tastes or those shapes or those flavors are just incredible. And the pride of doing it, and then the practice of it. You're getting healthy and hopefully spending time with kids and with family while you're out there. And I always recommend bring kids in for the harvest. save the weeding for later. You don't want to traumatize them.
what was interesting too, I was thinking about is I remember I bought a book one time, and I don't know where it is right now, but it was a catering book. I don't know why. Some reason I wanted to be a caterer at one time. I have no idea reason why. But it had different vegetables. You're right, though. It's like carrots. I don't see purple carrots very much around. The different kinds of beets, like different varieties of beets. And it's amazing. And you don't see those in the store that often or at all. But I mean, it was just amazing you can grow those things and stuff. But one thing I was interested too, I know you live in Puerto Rico. What's it? And you lived in the States. Is it the soil in Puerto Rico better than in the States? I was kind of curious.
No, not really. I did a lot of homesteading in Texas for a decade and a half. I did some homesteading in Southern Oregon for a while. And again, very different climate there. You know, lots of rain, lots of overcast. And then I was in Colorado for a few years, which was high desert and very cold. And now I'm in Puerto Rico. And I just love it. We're really headed into some very, very, very difficult times. And I thought, well, yeah, I just don't want to go through that. I love chocolate. So I want to go somewhere where chocolate grows. So I'm moving to Puerto Rico. And I love it. I suppose it's like any skill. When you have it, you want to expand it, challenge yourself. And so like, growing in Texas is one thing, and then growing in Colorado is an entirely different thing. In a lot of ways, they're the same, but it's different. And so growing in all different regions really has, I have an appreciation for the underlying principles that are unique to all of them and how to teach a much broader audience better. I love Puerto Rico. It's just fun here. It's interesting. Honestly, when people say, what's the easiest place to grow in? And this is a little counterintuitive, but the high desert, if you have water and deserts, if you have water and access to good water, because there's much less insect pressure and there's much less weed pressure, but you have to have water. So actually that's one of the easier growing regions here in the tropics. I mean, stuff grows here. It's so much farmer. It really does grow because we get a lot of moisture and the temperatures are pretty good year round. but we definitely don't ever get a freeze. And a freeze in some areas is awesome because it'll set back your insect populations. So we've got bugs and we've got iguanas, and you know, everywhere has its challenges. You just figure it out, and everybody always has. Like, as I said, you know, it used to be homegrown food on every table, and it will be again sooner. I'll tell you my other biggest threat and concern, other than this war situation we're finding ourselves into that is not being televised. the revolution will not be televised. I don't, you know, like, it's happening, this attack on our food supply. But we have the other thing going on with the U.S. dollar. I don't think we're able to pay the interest on the debt anymore. Like, they have to keep printing money just to pay the interest on the debt. So we're at the end. And then that whole BRICS, you know, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and now a slew more countries have joined that. When in August of last year, when Saudi Arabia joined, I said, that's it. That's the end of the petrodollar. It's just going to be a matter of time before the U.S. dollar collapses. And when that happens, then we're going to see hyperinflation, which happens to every single fiat currency. Mm-hmm. And you know, Germany, Weimar Germany is one of the most classic examples of it, although it's happened to every single fiat currency throughout history. We know how this unfolds. There's thousands of currencies that have gone through this, and there's lots of people who have studied the life cycles of inflation and hyperinflation and currency collapse. But even in Weimar Germany, which was like 1921, it happened very fast. So prices had been going up and going up over like 2 or 3 years. And they saw a dozen eggs go from like a half a mark to 3 marks. And they were all outraged like that in January. By September of that year, it was like 1 million marks for a dozen eggs.
Oh, wow.
So in 9 months, food bait became completely, absolutely unaffordable. And I don't, you know, now in our hyper-connected smartphone instantaneous world, how fast will it happen here? We can only guess. But as you're seeing from the price increases going up and up and up, and it seems like they're, you know, we're on that bathtub curve, right? We've just hit that curve for a great example. Go do, it was so funny to me, actually, the chocolate has become the very first food commodity to go hyperinflation. So a couple of months ago, you know, look at the a ton of cocoa, which is chocolate, was $3,000 a ton. These are, you know, like Hershey's and these big companies that buy it. It's now $12,000 a ton. It's gone in two months.
That's crazy.
And it's not stopping. So first advice is go stock up. I bought 20 chocolate bars and I thought, I'm going to stock up on chocolate. And then I ate them all in 2 weeks. It was terrible. I'm like, I can't stock up
on chocolate.
It's not a good plan for me. I was having such a great week.
I ate all of the chocolate bars.
Anyway, chocolate is going to get really, really expensive. And you'll see this start to happen with all kinds of different commodities, food commodities, you know. Oranges, I think there was a big problem with something with the oranges in Florida this year. Last year, peanuts in Georgia, right as they were about to harvest, there was this freak storm where they got flooded out. So the peanut harvest was, I mean, there's just all of these things adding up, and not any one of them can you point to it and say, you know, that's a big deal. It's kind of like a Jenga game, right? I'm sure you play Jenga with your son.
Yeah,
you take out this block and nothing happened. You take out that block and nothing happened. You take out this block and nothing happens. But I think we're at the point where we're starting to see that tower is getting pretty wobbly. But the saving grace in it, again, is you can grow your own food. It's unbelievably pleasurable. You can, just to give you a snapshot, in a backyard-sized space, like assuming you got a house on a quarter acre, which is kind of the standard American tract house, right? You can grow, as a beginner, at least half of your own food in that backyard size space. And that's actually the first presentation we have of at the Wartime Home Front series. And it's very inspiring. Like, you can do this. It's not that hard. You know, like, it's totally possible.
What else are they going to be talking about this weekend at the home, the Wartime?
So if anybody's looking to buy property, Jeff Lawton is the world's foremost permaculturist. And he has this really wonderful presentation. The first 15 minutes of it is he's showing, when he looks at a property, what does he see? And he's kind of got this generic, undeveloped, you know, couple of acres, and he draws on it and he shows you where he would, what he would do in terms of earthworks and where he would dig this or plant that. And it's just really neat to see, like, a guy who has, you know, decades of experience working with the land. What does he see? And then on the back half of that presentation, he shows you how he's implemented almost all of those different things he talks about in his research center, his farm. So that's a really wonderful presentation for the people who are looking to buy land. We also have tomatoes. I consider tomatoes a survival food, honestly, because if you've got tomatoes, you know, you got Mexican, you got Italian, you got Thai, you got all of the, you got chili, you got soup, you stew. So we have a whole presentation just in depth where we interview all these experts on growing tomatoes to get everybody's perspective from all these different bioregions on how to grow tomatoes. A couple of years ago, I had an opportunity to interview Dr. Kai-Fu Lee, who is one of the world's foremost experts in artificial intelligence. And it was really quite an honor to, this guy's a self-made billionaire, and he's Chinese-American. He's worked on both sides, speaks, you know, both languages fluently, and had worked for Google, had worked for Apple, and had worked for Microsoft at the highest levels of development in AI. So this guy, he is definitely an expert. And we go over to artificial intelligence and the future of food and what he sees coming down the pipe, and especially as it relates to backyard food production. And I'll just give you a little teaser on that, is he had some really interesting comments about Elon Musk. You know, Elon Musk has been shouting all this stuff about AI, and Dr. Lee really had some interesting comments about Elon. You might want to watch that one. We have another one. A lot of people are very interested. For one of the first things you're going to learn when you start growing crude is that you can't do it on your own, and you need community. And so there's a whole segment on how to very quickly find like-minded neighbors and build a self-reliance network in your neighborhood. And how to do that without sacrificing OPSEC. And for those of you that don't have a military or paramilitary background, you know, a bit of the survival and preparedness space, I'm like, I feel like I'm part military almost. OPSEC means operational security. So, you know, one of the rules of prepping is you really don't want a lot of other people knowing what you have. How do you find like-minded people, and how do you get to know people, and how do you do it? And a very simple formula and a very simple thing that I've actually done in several communities now, and built networks. And you do need networks, right? You do. And hopefully all of you are going to get standardized on either city radios or handheld radios or something, and communications and skills share and that kind of thing, you know?
Well, it's interesting too, because we can talk, it can be another whole show on just on community and stuff like that.
Yeah, you can definitely go see the presentation at the Wartime Skills, and then perhaps I'll come back on the show and talk to people specifically about that. You know, a lot of people go, oh my God, Marjorie, I talk about raising rabbits because they're just such a great meat source in the backyard. We can never butcher a bunny. And I totally understand that, right? Well, that's why you have community, because I promise you there's somebody who's a hunter or a fisherman, and you go like, hey, here's 10 rabbits. If you process them, you keep 2 and give me the 8 or whatever number you all negotiate or agree on. You know, there's people in your community with skills. One morning, this was quite a while ago, we were working on a project, and I sliced open my leg with a piece of sheet metal. My husband's, you know, driving like a maniac to get me to hospital. And all I'm thinking about is, oh my God, what happens if the kids wake up and the truck's gone, mom and dad are gone, and there's blood all over the barn? We had at least 5 neighbors I could call. Immediately, they were over there waking the kids up, letting them know mom and dad were fine, fixing them breakfast. It was such a relief to me. But, you know, you got to have community. And in that case, I did go to the hospital, but there are people in my community who know how to clean that wound and sew it up. You got to have community. And it's a lot of fun, too. It just makes life so much more fun to have a like-minded group of people to share birthdays with and celebration and do work parties together. You know, you need to get that barn built, or you need to get this cleaned out or something done. We used to organize work parties, and it was just so much fun to help each other that way.
Well, it's definitely interesting too. They can find more about about this week and about all the skills and stuff for the wartime and the thing you're the webinar you put on this weekend. You can go, I know we have a link.
A dad grows food. I love that too, Joe. And I just love how you're with your son and you guys are picking fruits. And oh, one of the other conversations in there is food preservation. So Jill Winger and I, between the two of us, we have 45 years of food homesteading experience. And we go over 9 different ways of food, freezing, drying, freeze drying, smoking, all the different ways that you can preserve food. And she and I riff on each one, how often we use it, whether we like it or not, is it practical? And, you know, that kind of thing. Homesteader Jill also runs a small farm, so she often brings that angle in, like if you want to become a farmer. And that will immediately help you focus on what's important to do and get started with and what's going to be most cost effective and what you do not need to waste any time or money on. So it'll help save. But one of the great strategies now is, as we get into summertime and there's an abundance, you know, you can go to your local farmer and you're like, hey, can I pick up, get a couple of cases of those, if you can manage to not eat all those strawberries. And then turn them into jam and put them in your pantry or, go to your local farmers and say, hey, instead of this little bag, can I buy, a bushel or a big box of green beans? And then, canning is a very simple skill that you can pick up. And then, start making your own backup food supply. And you can do it from the harvest of what's going on right around you.
Definitely true. You can find more about the skills this weekend with the Wartime Homefront Essential Skills Masterclass, a 10-part masterclass. Free streaming on April 27th and the 28th. And they can find the links at dadgrowsfood.com. I think I said it right this time.
Yes, you did.
It'll take you to the Grow Network and find out. Well, wrapping up, final thoughts. Anything you want to leave with the audience? Wrapping up, anything we might not cover?
When I got into this about 20 years ago, and I was just completely freaked out. I mean, scared, night sweats, just shaking. Because I saw the vulnerabilities of the food supply, and it was basically... the creator, Great Spirit, saying, I used to be a professional investor and before that an engineer, and basically God said, nope, you're not doing that anymore. You need to learn how to grow food and teach other people how to grow food. And I'm like, really? Why me? And it just shook me so bad, just so badly. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this. I will tell you that was the best thing I've ever done in my life. Since then, I have been growing my own food. I will always grow my own food, even if we weren't facing, hyperinflation, currency collapse, wartime, whatever, another pandemic, whatever is coming down the pipe. I will always be growing my own food because it's so pleasurable and it's so beneficial to my health. And I have a deep sense of security that no amount of insurance is ever going to pay for. And it's just the best thing. And you too, once you start growing food, even just start with a few herbs on the windowsill and you'll grow and your skills will get better. You're going to look back on that and go, that was the best thing I ever did. So don't be afraid of it. Embrace it. Have a good time with it. And remember that the early adopters have the advantage.
Margie, thank you much for being on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. All links will be in the show notes for this episode. Thank you for your time and thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you, Joe.